You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 33, Vorik Ex Machina. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Priceline killing off Shatner, the ThinkGeek electronic door chime, Transparent Aluminum, Star Trek Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, updates on the TNG Remastered Project, and IDW's Star Trek Ongoing No. 5, Operation Annihilate! Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt as we discuss the Voyager episode, Blood Fever. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I am doing fantastically, Chris. You know, the smokes are American spirit. Mrs. Ron is not here. And remember, no whining.
Sounds like you've been continuing your Battlestar Galactica viewing marathon.
Indeed, I have. Yes. I'm just starting season 3. And this is when the podcasts start getting really, really good.
Yeah, I haven't listened to those in quite a few years, and I need to go back and do it. Actually, since you've been doing it, I've been thinking about watching them myself again.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. I've got a few people on Twitter watching it with me, and a friend of mine who's actually watching it for the very first time, and she's got some questions about, aren't there supposed to be 12 Cylon models? Why are we only seeing 7 Cylon models? And I just give her a knowing look and tell her just to wait. Oh, just wait.
Yeah, because the show wouldn't be very interesting if they just told us up front who they all were, right?
Exactly. One of these days I'm going to do the miniseries, and I'm just going to flash Cylon on screen every time a Cylon appears, which is about, if you've watched the entire show or if our listeners have, but it's about half the cast ends up being a Cylon by the end. So, yeah. That'll be quite a video when I finally get it done.
I like the 13th Cylon that doesn't really show up later on, the little dog that's running around.
Yes. Well, Jake was
in
a Cylon.
In the TV movie?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you another thing, Greg. Now, based on your power situation over the past 3 to 4 days, I'm inclined to think that perhaps Seattle had the storm of the century because it's either that or your local power company is being run by Chief Engineer Argyle.
That is what I heard. You know, after he got kicked off NextGen, he came back and started running Puget Sound Energy. Because, yes, the moment the snow started falling from the sky, it's like he panicked and shut it all off. You know, maybe it's Captain Picard because he ran away and blew it all up.
Maybe. I was just very surprised at how long your power was off after the storm.
Yeah, it was out. Maybe the storm started Tuesday or Wednesday, and it was off from Wednesday morning up until yesterday afternoon. So that was Saturday afternoon. So about 4 days, I was solidly without power.
Wow, that's incredible. I think some of our listeners know that you used to live in Sendai in Japan, right at the epicenter of the big earthquake last March. Mm-hmm. And I believe you told me that your power from this snowstorm in Seattle was off twice as long as your power was off after the great Tohoku earthquake last March.
Yeah, my power was back. The earthquake, as you know, was Friday afternoon. Or was that Thursday afternoon? Well, now it's
fuzzy. It was Friday.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Friday.
And the power was back Saturday evening.
Yep.
And so that's about a day and a half. I barely got used to it being out, and they already had it back up and running. And here, yeah, it was out immediately and was out for 4 or 5 days. I'm astonished. I mean, I understand. It was a big snowstorm. There's a lot of ice. We have about half as many trees as we had before the storm.
We're going to have
to start shipping in trees from Vancouver or something.
I can see the trucks coming down the highway now.
Yes. But it was nice. You know, it's nice to see Seattle in the snow. We've got a few listeners here, and I think they'd agree with me that when it first starts falling, it makes the city look really nice. But then it takes about a day, and it all turns to brown sludge, and it's just not fun anymore. You just want it to all melt, and you want the power to be back. And, get back to quote unquote spring, which is just when it rains, you know, all day.
Well, you know, as we jump into some Star Trek news here, what is fun, unlike that, is the Priceline ads with William Shatner. And I know you were in Japan for a number of years, like I have. So I don't know if you've been able to see all these ads that have been running. I've only seen a fair number of them myself, but they're finally giving Shatner the boot, as it seems. Have you seen this commercial that's going to be running this upcoming week?
I've seen the most recent one, and honestly, I'm surprised. After the Star Trek VI Negotiator commercial, I'm surprised they didn't end it all with one from Generations and have him show up and fight Dr. Soren and tell him how to, you know, save money on a hotel. You know, if you can't go to the Nexus, you know, surely Las Vegas is the next best thing.
Right. Or maybe he can find the best rates to get you to the Nexus.
That's true, you know.
And also a cabin once you get there.
Right. You know, you can't fly a starship into it, and you can't, you know, bring it to the planet, but perhaps an airplane. You know, did he try an airplane from Priceline.com? Anyway.
You know, I don't think he did. He was just really, you know, he went to the extreme measures, you know, like blowing up stars and,
right,
and things like that, when maybe he just needed to call the Negotiator, William Shatner, and get hooked up with Priceline.
Indeed. So in this, he ends up dying just as in Star Trek Generations, and he even dies on a bridge, which is a perfect way. Well, I guess falling off a bridge, but still, it's a perfect way for William Shatner to die in any medium.
That's right. Yeah, they didn't do an exact parallel to his death in Star Trek, but I think falling off a bridge, it's pretty close. Tell me about the Star Trek VI Priceline commercial now.
I'm trying to remember what it was. This is a real commercial where they digitally inserted modern day Shatner into clips from the original film. And it was a few years ago. I'm trying to remember. We'll have to find it on YouTube.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
I believe it. Maybe it was the DirecTV, but it was William Shatner being digitally inserted into a film clip. I lose track of what William Shatner is selling himself for. You know, William Shatner sold out years ago, and I don't solidly have a problem with that, but there are a lot of products that he helped sell.
Do you remember the Priceline commercial with Shatner and Leonard Nimoy?
Yes, vaguely. I believe they were competing, right? Nimoy?
Well, they were. They call Shatner, the Priceline executives call Shatner into the office, and they tell him that we're going to have to let you go. And then at the end, he says, well, who could replace me? And then Nimoy walks in the door and he says, oh, hi, Bill. And
right.
then the look of on Shatner's face, he realizes, oh, I'm being replaced by
right.
Leonard.
There we go. Actually, it's kind of the other way around, where Shatner comes in and replaces Nimoy as director after Star Trek 3. And he does Star Trek 5. But no, Nimoy is a great sport about that. I hope he does more stuff. I don't think we've seen anything from Nimoy since the... Which band was that? He did a music
Bruno
video.
Mars video. Yeah,
for Bruno Mars, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe he'll chime in on this whole Star Wars versus Star Trek debate.
Oh, yes, because that's what we need, are a few more people chiming in on that.
Right. Goodness.
Oh, right.
But
well,
so Shatner's no longer doing the Priceline Negotiator.
Yeah,
that's
apparently not.
It's kind of an end of an era, because that was, I don't know when he started, sometime in the last decade, right? Early last decade.
Yeah, I spent about 5 years, I think, since he started doing this. Maybe a little bit longer, but... well, actually, no, I think I think I have some notes here. About 14 years
when
he first started doing things with Priceline. I forgot it had been that long.
Yeah, he was doing ads here or there. He didn't do the whole Negotiator character.
The Negotiator is 5 years.
Until 5 years ago. But as far as just doing ads for Priceline, it's been about a decade and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
Watch those straight through. I mean, they're 30 seconds each, so just watch them straight through, and you can actually watch William Shatner gain weight as the commercials go by.
Well, maybe in that vein, maybe they can bring Jonathan Frakes on and can continue the tradition.
Frakes, the Negotiator, the next generation.
manual control.
Yeah, he'll fly people there by a joystick will pop out and he'll fly people to their destination.
Right.
For just $99.
Very good.
Oh, that would be a good one. All right. Well, apparently this ad is going to be running the week that this episode of The Ready Room comes out. This last ad of William Shatner should be on TV there in the U.S.
Right. I believe it. It'll probably be airing the... I believe it's the 49ers-Giants game is on right now, and it's probably one of those, that sort of event that they're going to start playing this sort of commercial ad. I'll have to ask my friends who are watching the game rather than doing Star Trek podcasts if they saw the ad and what they thought of it as a non-Star Trek fan.
We'll have to ask friend of the show and Hyperchannel host Tristan Riddell because, you know, he loves the football so much that even if he weren't having to watch the game because of his work, he would be watching it anyway, probably recording it so he could watch it again tomorrow.
Again and again, yes. Someone on Twitter said that they hate watching football when they have to watch somebody's leg break over and over again. And I was saying, oh yeah, you know, when you rewind it on your DVR and play it back in slow motion, it does get a little... I don't understand football. I really don't. I don't understand who watches it or why. I know that's sort of a cliche, you know, nerds disliking sports, but I don't understand.
Well, as you know, on the flip side, I am possibly a bigger college football fan than I am a Star Trek fan, if that tells you anything.
So. Right. Well, you can have your football. I'll stick with Pyramid. Thank you.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, last thing on this story, just a quote from Shatner. He told the AP that I'm in grief mode. It's not the first time I've had an iconic character die off. So he feels strongly about the Negotiator.
I wonder if they brought in Ronald Moore to write his death scene.
That would be funny. Priceline commercial written by Ronald D. Moore.
Yes.
All right. Well, moving on to the next story, Greg. Now, here's something that it's been out since last week, but we decided to talk about something different last week. But I think that you really, really want this item as well.
I definitely do. You know, if there's one thing I love, it's classic 23rd century design. And this is the door chime from the original series, which looks like you can mount on your wall. I'm sure this will be seen on an upcoming season of The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, I'm sure. So it hasn't been on there yet. This is a new item, I guess. So it will definitely appear.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure. You know what I love about this 23rd century design is it seems that although aesthetically it leaves a lot to be desired compared to Apple products, one thing that Steve Jobs always championed is here, and that's the single button.
Right.
I like how this door chime has only one button, and by pressing it, you can activate the communicator sound.
Right. Now, is it the sound of the communicator that... The tweet tweet or whatever that sound is, or is it the boatswain whistle, the whoo? You know which one of those it is?
Well, it wouldn't be the chirp chirp one
right.
That we're used to from the Next Generation. The boatswain whistle, was that? Gosh, you know, it's funny. It's one of those things like you watch it so much that it becomes something you're so accustomed to you don't even
right.
think about it anymore. I'm trying to remember if that's the standard communication sound on the original Enterprise, or if it's the thing that they just do always in the transporter room. You know, there's the boatswain whistle,
right? I think
it's on. I think it's the main communicator.
Yeah,
sound.
I mean, what happens a lot, like when I almost said Shatner, when Kirk is trying to communicate to the whole crew. You know, say now hear this,
yeah, that one.
All that, and then they'll play the whistle at that point.
Yeah,
but I think it's
yeah.
sort of a yeah the a public
your,
address
your,
whistle.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah,
surely
yeah,
that's
yeah.
what this plays, which is going to be fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I think what I'm thinking there is that's not used for every single time they press anything
no,
to communicate
not, right.
with each other, but it is like the, hey, here, I need your attention
exactly.
communicator sound is the boatswain
right.
whistle. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that that's probably what this plays, though.
Right. And not only
that.
That
would be the iconic sound.
Yeah. And so it also has a motion detector, right? So when someone walks through your door, it plays that sound
yeah.
of the door
yes.
opening.
Yes, it does. And that will be used to great effect on The Big Bang Theory. I'm
sure it will be. You know, one of my favorite bits I neglected to talk about when we were discussing Star Trek VI the other day, is when Nimoy actually holds the door open, the turbolift door open. So often the turbolift sort of knows when you want the door closed and or open. And in this case, Nimoy actually puts his arm out, holds the door closed while he says something pithy to Valeris, and then lets it go. Which I thought was a great bit of, like, let's remember this is an actual device that actually works in a specific way.
Right. That's why Stuart Baird thinks it's an elevator.
That's right.
He remembers that scene. So then when he got on to film Nemesis, he's like, oh, there's one of those cool elevators I like.
That's right. Oh, Stuart Baird. Have we actually done Nemesis yet? I'm trying to remember if we've done Nemesis or we just talked around it so much.
Yeah, we did Nemesis because that was our episode of Patrick Brent Worf and Laverne.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
We didn't have Brian Finifter on it. We had someone else that I'm forgetting at the moment. I feel like we need to do it again because I've heard Brian talking, friend of the show, Brian Finifter, talking about Nemesis recently. And you haven't heard Bile until you've heard Brian on Star Trek Nemesis.
Well, even though Brian was not on our actual Nemesis show, he has managed to insert a lot of comments about Nemesis and Stuart Baird right into other discussions. So I can only imagine if the show were actually focused on Nemesis,
yes,
what that might be like.
Very good. Very good. I do want to mention to everyone, John Logan is, again, an amazing, amazing screenwriter, and it's not his fault that Nemesis was terrible. This is another thing. I want to talk about John Logan one of these days on the show. He has a new movie coming out, another new movie that looks fantastic, and it just continues to prove to me that he needs to just work with directors who aren't terrible, and it ends up being a good movie. I believe Ralph Fiennes is doing his latest film, and Steven Spielberg did his last one.
I see. You know, it's funny how Star Trek conversations kind of wind their way towards Nemesis, even when it has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about. But somehow, when you're discussing Star Trek, there's always some way to tie things back to Nemesis.
Indeed it is. Well, to segue from Nemesis to my second favorite Star Trek movie, Star Trek IV, it looks like the next story on our news lineup is about transparent aluminum.
Yes, that's right. Computer.
Hello computer.
Greg, stop talking to your mouse right there.
I have a mouse.
Saw you doing that.
It's not even plugged in, but I went and got it so that I could talk into it during the show. It's too bad the listeners at home can't appreciate that.
Yeah, I know. That's great audio right there, Greg. But yeah, transparent aluminum is what Scotty traded for the plexiglass that they needed to build the holding tank
right
for the wells. And, you know, it's been hard to believe that in our own timeline now, it has been 25 years since Scotty gave the formula for transparent aluminum to Dr.
Wow.
Nichols of Plexicore. And now in the movie, I mean, we've been waiting a while, but to be fair, Dr. Nichols did say in the movie that it mm-hmm. would take him years to work out the dynamics of the Matrix, and he was right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 25 years, that sounds reasonable considering he didn't do any of the original research. You know, it's what Ian Malcolm talks about in The Lost World, about how if you stand on the shoulders of people who actually do the work, it's going to take you longer, you're going to make mistakes. If you didn't do the original research, it's going to take you longer. So obviously, 25 years, but here we are. Thanks to Montgomery Scott, we finally have transparent aluminum. Now, what is transparent aluminum actually good for other than... what is it good for?
Transparent aluminum, what is it good for?
Sounds like
a good book title.
Wrapping baked potatoes, and you really want to see the potato while it's baking?
Yeah. It's good for, wrapping Christmas presents for kids who just don't have the patience to actually wait to unwrap them to find out what's in there. Well, first I should say this is not exactly transparent aluminum, but it is a substance that is 1.6 inches thick, unlike the 1 inch thick that
right.
Scotty promised. And it can withstand temperatures of up to 1200 degrees Celsius, and it is transparent. And as for what they use it for, right now, it's very, very expensive. and it's primarily used in military applications, like to create lenses for battlefield optics or for armored windows and for covering the sensors on missiles.
I see. And so perhaps a next generation Pope Mobile.
That's right. It could be used for that as well. It's a substance called aluminium oxynitride, and nice. It's made by a company called Cermet Corporation in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And it is 4 times harder than fused glass silica, and it's 85% as hard as sapphire. And again, 1.6 inches thick. They sell it under a brand name called A-Line, and mm-hmm. I was reading, so StarTrek.com reported on this, and then there was an article in the Daily Mail from the UK, and they mention in there that some initial research on this goes back to the early 80s. I think it said 1981. So, you know, it's possible, though not a guaranteed connection, that the writers were kind of aware of this, you know, substance being around, and maybe it worked its way into the script for The Voyage Home, although it's probably more of a coincidence, but the idea goes back to then.
Well, what I think happened was after Scotty so successfully sold the concept to that guy in 1986, he then went back to 1981 and sold it to someone else for even more money.
Probably. I mean, that's how time travel works. Now, what do you think about the, what would it be like, the rejected Star Trek IV plot in which the transparent aluminum probe comes to Earth?
Well, it would be 1.6 inches thick. It would be 85% as hard as sapphire. So, you know, phasers would have no effect. I guess I'm not sure what it would do to the Earth's oceans. Perhaps, you know, it could wrap them. It could create like a tank, and the oceans could go into the tank somehow. But I'm not sure. The main part of the probe is what it's looking for. And maybe it's looking for regular aluminum. Maybe regular aluminum has died out by the 23rd century.
Ah, that's right. It's all been replaced by transparent aluminum. That's how Scotty changed the future. See, Scotty,
there you go.
He wasn't supposed to give this formula to Dr. Nichols in 1986, and he did. And it hastened the disappearance of normal aluminum.
That explains the clear Coke cans that we see after Star Trek IV.
That's right. Exactly. And it also explains why there's no Reynolds wrap in the future.
Ah, I see. I see.
So the probe comes and it starts spraying transparent aluminum, and it actually coats the Earth's oceans.
Yes.
Which creates all kind of problems for the weather systems. And, you know, within a week, the power's out everywhere, and it's out for about 4 days. Because at that point in time, the Puget Sound Power Company is operating the power grid for the entire planet.
on an upside, you can now go roller skating on any water surface. Because it's just this nice, smooth, transparent aluminum. It's actually quite pretty.
All right. Well, this is, anyway, interesting. Right now, it's 1.6 inches thick, but you have to think that it's going to get thinner and thinner. Mm-hmm. As time goes on, production costs would go down, I'm sure. And, you know, it's one of these Star Trek technologies that in the future, I think we will see it as a part of daily life, you know, and then we will have transparent Reynolds wrap that you can wrap your leftover potato in.
And protect it from bullets.
Speaking of which, there is the Cermet Corporation has a video out on YouTube demonstrating A-Line. They are transparent aluminum. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes, along with the articles here that we mentioned as well, if you want to find out more about it.
I'm just imagining that scene from Captain America. You know, perhaps they can hand the Cap a shield made of transparent aluminum and then just shoot him like 10 times and just, you know, hey, it works. I don't know if you've seen Cap America,
not the movie. I have not seen the movie.
There seem to be similarities between vibranium and aluminium oxynitride. There seem to be similarities. So perhaps Captain America could actually have an Elon shield in case they can't invent vibranium in time.
You may remember, Greg, we have a big department store here called Eon. and in Japan. And I'm just picturing future Aeon stores being sponsored by A-Line with the entire buildings being made out of this transparent aluminum.
Have you seen, I don't know if there's one in Tokyo, but the Aeon building in Sendai is actually just this huge glass structure with this really nice, like cubes of glass. It looks like an Apple store from the outside. It's really beautiful.
No, I haven't seen that. Ours is quite old, so.
Oh, okay.
It just looks like a typical Japanese store.
Oh, okay. I actually worked inside the Aeon building. I'll have to send you a picture.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Very nice.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Yeah, perhaps, you know, the next gen Aeon building could be made of transparent aluminum. That would be very nice.
All right. Well, if you want to build something like that, Greg, you're going to need a lot of money. And so our next story might help you get that. This combines one of our favorites, a video game, with another popular show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And
indeed,
we have Who Wants to Be a Starfleet Millionaire?
Which is a bit of an oxymoron, honestly. It's sort of like saying, you know, who wants to be a Starfleet Emperor? You know,
it's Hoshi.
Well, yes, Hoshi does, but, you know, they don't have money in the future, so you can't be a Starfleet millionaire. But I believe the idea is it's a Star Trek quiz show that you can play.
That's right.
Yes, and you're, instead of a really cheap set with a bunch of lights, you're actually on the bridge of a Constitution-class starship, which is very cool. Now,
I thought that was a cheap set with lots of lights.
And yes, thank you. But my question is this William Shatner's new gig now that he's no longer the Priceline negotiator? Is he taking over for Regis Philbin?
Oh man, that would be awesome. No, I don't think that's the case. But how cool
is that? Your final answer.
How great would that show be if William Shatner were the host?
It really would be fantastic.
That would be awesome. I would love that. But as you say, that was my question here. As there is no money in the future, what exactly are you winning a million of? Is it like a million tribbles? Is it a million bottles of Romulan Ale?
Yes. Well, I mean, a million... now, what do they call them? A million bars of gold-pressed latinum. That would be pretty good. You could buy quite a few Dabo girls with that much gold-pressed latinum.
You could, but to get that, I think you have to be kind of out in the far reaches of the Federation, like in Bajor.
That's probably true.
In the Bajor system, anyway. But, well, this is going to be for PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. Like you said, it's set on the bridge of a Constitution class, and it has 600 questions about the original series. So it is going to be like a TOS-focused game.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious here about the licensing, because... so far, what I've read is that it includes Lieutenant Uhura, a Vulcan, a human cadet, and an Orion slave girl. Why is Uhura the only character with a name here?
That is a little bizarre. This is sort of a weird property. It's not from CBS Digital proper. It doesn't seem to me. So. It almost appears slapped together by some fans who somehow got a license.
Yeah, I don't think it's that. It is being produced by a video game company.
Right.
We have Double Six Games doing it. But it's only going to be available in Europe. It's not going to be available in North America.
Oh,
which
okay.
Does make me wonder again about, I mean, did they weren't able to get licensing to release it in North America, perhaps. I don't know. But so if you want to play it, you're going to need to be in Europe or have a way to, you know, accidentally gain access to one of the European stores, either PSN or the Xbox Live marketplace.
I think that's fairly easy if you're on the PSN. I think with Xbox, they really lock you in. I'm not exactly sure about that, but I know at least with the PlayStation Network, it's a little easier than you'd think to hop regions.
It is, actually, because I have a U.S. account as well.
There
it's a Japanese account on PSN. I mean, the only trick with any of these is getting money into the account so you can actually purchase anything. Creating an account, typically not so difficult.
My understanding, it's about 50,000 yen for about $20 worth of PlayStation merchandise.
Oh, if you want to buy cards from the game shops in Hong Kong or Singapore places.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. it reminds me, it's funny, you know, you go in the bookstore here and there are computer magazines that have like a 10-page feature walking you through step-by-step of how to create a U.S. iTunes account.
Right.
And they actually show you how to look up hotels in the U.S. online so that you can get the addresses of the hotel and use that as your address.
Very nice.
But it's funny because it's like just normal computer magazines. And
right.
Oh, cracks me up. Oh, man. But anyway, about this game, it's going to be available later this year. I don't have an exact release date yet, but it's part of a series of games that have been released of Special Edition, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. They did South Park game before this one.
And, it's very strange. Very strange.
Yeah, very strange. But it would be fun, I have to admit. I mean, I would really enjoy having this.
You know, we talked about on one of our first episodes a book of Star Trek trivia with quite a few questions and answers. I actually found it in a bookstore a couple weeks ago. Almost bought it. I might do it for our trivia day that we're going to do one of these weeks.
Is that the one that has the little thing on the front cover that you can press the buttons or something?
Yes, exactly. That's the one. But I was looking through it and, you know, there's a lot of trivia for Star Trek. And what I like is that because there's so much canon, there's a lot of really great trivia questions. You know, with Star Wars, the only canon is the movies. So you've either seen the movies and you can pretty much answer any trivia question, or it's going to go non-canon and you're going to go into the EU and, you know, there's tons out there, but who knows all that stuff. So with Star Trek, there's such a deep canon well of questions that trivia for Star Trek is one of my favorite pastimes.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Even if you've seen all the episodes, there's so much there that it's hard to remember it all.
Yeah.
And if you're put on the spot in a trivia game, it can be quite tough. Have you played the new Trek trivia that I put on the site this week, The Lives of Dax?
Well, as I've been without power, I'm behind a little bit on those things.
You haven't had any power. Go give it a try. I think it's a pretty tough one. There actually surprisingly is within Deep Space Nine enough information about all 10 hosts of Dax to create trivia about it.
You have on there how Esri Dax is the first Canadian Dax?
No, I'm going to put that as a bonus question.
Okay.
but go give that a shot. Anyway, this game, we will report on it when it comes out.
Right.
If we get that information. And I'm going to try to see if I can find a way to get my hands on it anyway, because I personally would love, since I don't have anyone around to play, you know, things like Scene at Star Trek or games where you need to have like a party and people around, being able to play something like this against the computer would be perfect for me.
Yes, that would be quite fun. And you know who you should ask if you're writing any sort of trivia book or trivia game is Mike and Denise Okuda, who are sort of the holders of all Star Trek knowledge. I mean, we talked to Larry Nemechek. He is really, really deep into it. But Mike and Denise really built the universe, and they're sort of the go-to people. And I guess they were involved in the TNG remastering. Is that right?
Oh, yes, definitely. I don't think CBS could do the TNG remastering without having Mike and Denise Okuda involved. Right. There's so much about the production of the series from the Next Generation forward, especially Next Generation, I think, that no one else knows except them. I mean, I can't imagine who you could go to and just ask any little detail that you need to know as you're doing this and find someone who knew everything the way they do.
Yeah, I don't think there's a single other person whose name is in every single episode from Next Gen on. Mike and Denise, they're credited in every single episode as far as whether they're working on the show or if they're consultants. It's just, they're always there. They're the sort of people who you could show a shot, you know, a new CG shot of the Enterprise D, and they'll point out some little detail you got wrong. You know, the fans are going to get you anyway, so why not ask someone first?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been interesting to hear their thoughts on the project. StarTrek.com did a two-part interview with them in which they talk about this as well as books and other things. And then TrekNews.net did a summary of what they talked about just as it relates to the TNG remastering. And I mean, some of this, you know, you probably already know how it kind of came about, but they did mention that they got a call a few years ago from CBS asking that if we ever decided to do TNG remastered, you know, do HD, would you be interested in being involved? And of course they said they would, but they said to each other that, oh, it'll never happen. They're just checking. They're never going to do this.
Well, it's sort of what we talked about, you know, one of the early episodes on the show is there's just so much work. Are they really going to go through and recut everything and redo the effects to remaster it onto film? It seems like a crazy project that, you know, it's astonishing that they're doing it. I totally understand why the Okudas would think that they just wouldn't even bother.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you would, going back and doing, what is it, 178 episodes, I think, of Next Generation? Just an incredible amount of work. But it did get the green light, and now they've been working on it. And one interesting thing that came out of this interview was, where are they within the project right now? Because, Greg, am I correct in thinking that we actually saw on screen in one of the trailers that they said all seven seasons are coming in 2012? Or was that just something that someone kind of thought they understood from it, and then it got passed around and kind of became like a...
Yeah, my understanding is the video I saw said that the sampler disc was coming, you know, January 30th, and then season one in 2012.
Okay, season one.
I think that got somewhere along the line, that got mistranslated into some article we saw that said all seven seasons. Because there's no way they're going to have it done. I'm expecting maybe a season a year. They might be able to do two, but I'm expecting holiday of every year for the next 7 years. We're just going to get one TNG season.
Interesting. Yeah, we talked about that before, you and I did on here, about what we expect in terms of a release. Yeah, I always thought that trying to do all seven seasons for 2012 would just be impossible. Yeah. At the same time, I think they have to release more than one per year. But in this interview, they do say that they are still in season one right now. They're still working on it. So it was good to know where they are within the project. As far as, you know, release schedule goes, here's the thing for me. I think they are doing this project for the viability of syndication of the Next Generation. Yep. I don't think that they are doing it to release it on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
They're just releasing it on Blu-ray so people can buy it. But they know that pretty soon, within just a couple of years, that TV stations are not going to accept SD content anymore.
Yeah.
And if they want to keep making residuals from syndication, they're going to have to have HD version of this. And that holds true for all the other series as well. Of course, Enterprise was shot in HD, but Voyager and the Next Generation and DS9 were not. And I think they're going to have to do the same thing for DS9 and the same thing for Voyager if they want to syndicate those as well. So I don't think they can take 7 years to remaster the Next Generation. I think they're going to have to get them all remastered probably within the next 5 years, all three of those series.
Well, so there's a couple things I'd say. I know the first season is going to be the hardest.
Yes.
And I'm not making a joke about it, you know, no one wanting to work on Justice. I'm saying it's really hard when you're first getting used to the workflow on how to do it. You know, they said those first few shots on Avatar took weeks and weeks, and then they were getting it down to a day or two to finalize a shot on Avatar, just because they got used to, over a couple years, the workflow and how to actually go from concept to reality. So even if it does end up taking the whole year to do season one, yeah, I expect they'll be able to speed it up. I still think, as far as releasing the Blu-rays, it's going to be one per holiday season, but you may be right as far as the syndication goes, that they may simply finish it for syndication, sell it to syndication, and go ahead and begin airing it. I mean, I believe TOS was airing not long before, but quite a bit before it actually sold on Blu-ray as the remastered versions.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think what you describe is probably true for the most part. Go ahead and finish it for syndication and then release the sets a bit more slowly. But I think they might follow the pattern that they did with the regular DVD sets, which, if I remember correctly, they released two seasons per year
Okay.
For those, didn't they do like one in the spring, one in the autumn, something like that?
It's very
varied, but
right. Yeah. I wouldn't be terribly surprised to see that. But as you say, you know, they also have the DS9 and Voyager projects to get on. I don't know how much those are a priority at CBS at the moment, but I imagine they want to have the same team continue to do it. They can't build a huge department for remastering Star Trek. It's going to be the same guys, and they're just going to have to get faster. And it's going to really depend, I think, in the next 6 months, seeing how quickly they can churn out quality work. Because there's a certain amount of effort that's going to have to go into it.
Yeah. Well, you know, like you said, doing the first season is going to be the toughest because of just learning the techniques of what they need to do. And then they will get quicker. Also, as they go through the seasons, the amount of work that needs to be done is a bit less as well. Because as you get towards the later seasons of The Next Generation, and then you get into DS9 Voyager, the quality of the source material, I think, is better.
Very true.
At that point as well. They have a little bit less work to do. But they will definitely get fast at doing it. You know, here in Japan, Deep Space Nine and Voyager are the two series that are running all the time on Super Channel. And everything that Super Channel shows pretty much is HD, except for a few things like Star Trek. And so I think the studio will have to look too at what is the cost benefit to having all these shows available in HD as well. And, you know, is there the market for, you know, it's never been said that they're going to do DS9. It's never been said that they're going to do Voyager.
That's
we're just speculating. If the goal were simply to sell Blu-rays, I think they might not do those later series because The Next Generation is like the series that I think has the widest general appeal. But if the goal is for syndication viability, then I do fully expect to see DS9 and Voyager remastered.
Yeah, and you know, you still got that pendulum that you talked about with Larry, and we're going to start having people who actually grew up not on Next Gen, but grew up on DS9, grew up on Voyager. Those are going to be the people in their 30s and 40s who have the money to spend reconnecting with their childhood. And so we're going to see a resurgence, I do believe, of those shows coming up rather soon, actually. I'd be a little worried about the early CG effects of Voyager holding up in HD. I'm sure the model shots from DS9 and the early model shots from Voyager will be fine. But Voyager may take a bit of work. But
that's a good point.
If I'm going to, you know, make a prediction at this point, you know, if we can look back in 10 years at what I said, I think in the next 10 years, all of Star Trek will be in HD. You know, I don't know if it'll be on Blu-ray.
Definitely.
I don't know if Blu-ray will be around at that point, but they're going to want to have it for syndication in the next 10 years, the entire thing, all 500, 600 episodes.
Yeah, it's actually 700.
Well, there you go.
It's a lot. But most definitely. You know, you mentioned resurgence there. I think we're already seeing a DS9 resurgence thanks to Netflix.
Definitely. Certainly.
Just watching Twitter, you can see that for sure.
Yeah.
One more quick thing on this, Greg, before we go on to our last story here today. TrekCore posted the artwork for the season one Blu-ray set. And it was nice to see this as opposed to the sampler, because I wasn't quite sure with the sampler if that was going to be the design of the packaging for all the seasons or if it was just kind of a thing that they quickly threw together and, you know, put it out, make it look kind of futuristic. But it appears that that is indeed the design.
Yeah, the one thing I'd worry about this box set is that it gets sent down on an away mission and be quickly killed.
That's true, because this package looks just like the sampler disc that's coming out, except it's red.
Right.
But now, it is the Next Generation, so
yes,
it might be
true.
Safe being red in this case.
It is Command. Now, is that Jonathan Frakes or is that Zach Quinto? Honestly, right there below Picard on the picture. I don't know if it's just the way they've washed it out, but he's got this haircut, looks like a dramatic bangs. I never noticed a resemblance between Frakes and Quinto before, but apparently it's there.
You're right. It does look a bit like him there, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, I think this is it's a pretty sharp looking case here. I would assume from what I'm seeing here that they're going to keep the color scheme from the DVD releases, because season one is red.
Oh, okay.
And the DVD releases as well. So
now, which season is Amazing Technicolor?
That's season 8. you know, the one with the cricket people. And...
Right. Very good.
All right. So we'll put links to all this stuff in the show notes, the interviews with the Okudas, also some links over to TrekCore where they have the cover art. And they've also done some screen stills of the special feature that's on the Next Level. They're showing some footage from when they originally shot the Enterprise model in front of a blue screen and so forth.
Very cool.
Pretty interesting stuff there. Well, Greg, it looks like we're going to get our own time to get away this week because there is no movie news. I looked around and I really couldn't find anything new to talk about.
Crazy. I mean, assumedly, Star Trek II, you know, The Triple King, has been shooting for about a week and a half now. But I guess they're so deep in actual production that Simon Pegg doesn't have time to tweet.
I guess so. That must be what's going on because, yeah, I didn't really find anything new for us to talk about. But we do have something movie related to talk about, and that's the Star Trek Ongoing Comics from IDW. Number 5 came out this past week, and as we've mentioned before, this is Operation Annihilate. Although I have to tell you, Greg, they did something, even before I opened it up and started reading it, they did something that really upset me this time.
Oh, what was that?
They removed the exclamation point from the title.
I see that.
It's Operation Annihilate.
Eh, you know, yeah. As you do.
Yeah, eh. But anyway, once you open it up, it's a pretty good comic. Did you have a chance to pick it up?
I did. I was thinking that the comic came out on the last Wednesday of the month. Maybe I was wrong, but I was totally expecting it to be next Wednesday. So I wasn't even thinking about it while we were having our snowstorm and power outage. I just completely neglected to find out that it had been released. But I did go ahead and pick it up today. The past 2 issues I haven't gotten in paper form. I've only gotten them on my iPad. But I'm actually really liking this as a way to read it. I wish the images were a little bit higher resolution. I wish I could zoom in. But other than that, I'm loving the iPad version, especially I'm loving that I can just download it from my bed.
Yeah, that's the thing. I read it on iPhone, so I have very small screen, but I do like the way that they've optimized it for that. You know, IDW, they changed their app a few weeks ago, and they're now using, was it Comixology, I think, app?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's branded as Star Trek Comics app still, but it works a little bit differently, and it was kind of rocky at first. Didn't work very well right out of the gate, but it's working pretty well now, and they've added, as you flip through the pages, they've added some kind of transitions around the page instead
right.
of just popping in and out.
Yeah, if you... I mean, on the iPad, it's not quite as important as on the iPhone, but you can... And I don't know if you could do this before. My understanding is you couldn't, but you can sort of tap on it and get just a single panel on the screen, and then it'll sort of go between it as you swipe forward rather than just go to the next page. It goes to the next panel.
Yeah, it does.
Which
that.
Is pretty cool.
It's pretty nice. So as for the story itself... I actually, as you know, when we talked about it here before, I was kind of disappointed with the first 2 issues with the Where No Man Has Gone Before. Mm-hmm. Felt a little bit better about the Galileo 7 until the ending where Uhura, you know, hijacks the shuttlecraft. This one, however, I actually quite like this issue a lot. What did you think about it?
I really did. You know, as I was saying on the other side of the room, I like how they're using this episode to sort of tell a new story. It doesn't feel like they're just trying to retread an old show or do the show with a higher budget. This just feels like Star Trek. You know, if you just were going to turn on, say they're just redoing the show, you know, just going to turn on an episode of the show, this is it. The effects, you know, quote unquote, are great. The characters are solid. I feel like they know who these characters are really well, and they're just going to go and tell a story. You know, Annihilate! Is not an episode I know that well. I meant to go back and watch it this week, but what with the power outage, I didn't get a chance to. But I remember it being one of the cheesier episodes.
Yeah.
You know, with the giant space amoebas. I mean, this isn't the giant space amoeba episode, but they're sort of the planet of amoebas.
Yeah.
That sort of latch onto you.
This isn't the giant space amoeba episode where it's actually out in space, but comparing them to normal amoebas, these are still giant.
Right, exactly.
Amoebas that also happen to look a lot like fried eggs.
Exactly. And it's very cheap plastic effects that are just sort of attached to them. Whereas you want them to be scary. And so going in, we were like, oh, they're gonna really do them justice. So that's a good thing. I don't know what got them to do this episode as their third episode, other than what we'll get to at the end, which leads me to talk about the beginning of the episode where the beginning of the comic where they deviate. Do you want to before we get into that? Okay, go ahead, Chris.
Well, before we get into that, why don't we just give everyone our spoiler warning?
Oh, yes.
So from this point forward, we're actually going to talk about what's in this issue. So if you haven't read it yet, you might want to pick it up, read it, and then come back here and listen to the rest of it. It won't take you long to read it. So moving forward, Greg, so your question here, I felt the same way at first when I knew it was going to be Operation Annihilate. I'm thinking, well, why? Why would you choose that episode out of all the episodes that you can choose? And that's the last episode of the first season as well. So they've skipped over, I think, what are there, 29 episodes in the first season or 28? It's actually the longest season in Star Trek. You skipped over a lot of episodes. But we know that these tie into the movie. They've told us they tie into the movie. They told us there was a clue to the subplot of the movie in issue number one. Here, I think that what we're going to be seeing here is what defines Kirk in the alternate timeline.
Right.
What happened in his life that makes him the man that he is, or the young man that he is at the beginning of the JJ movie? What defines him as a person, especially where his family is involved? And Operation Annihilate, because it dealt with the fact that Kirk's brother was on the planet and was killed in the original series, gave them material that they could work with here.
Right. And that's what I think makes sense. You know, it's not something that became a huge part of the original show. I don't know if the half-brothers... It's half-brother, right? Not full brother. This is the first kid of George and Winona.
Yeah, in this anyway, he would have to be the half brother, right? Because Yeah, I think so. A little confused on the timelines and who's full and half and who's older and who's younger. But certainly, as you've said before, in the JJ movie, we get the impression that Kirk was the firstborn in the alternate timeline. Anyway,
I mean, the fact that they were trying to decide should he be named after my father or yours, that's something you do with your firstborn. You know, you don't name the first one something else, and then say, well, this is the kid whose name really matters. Let's talk about that. So, but anyway, I don't think that you're going to remind me what his brother's name is. Is it Sam?
George.
George. Thank you.
I think there is a Sam too, though, right? Sam comes up at some point as well.
I don't. Yeah, but anyway, George.
We're all confused here.
It's terrible.
But it's George. Yeah.
Yes, it just wasn't coming to my brain. I don't think George is ever really mentioned. I mean, there's the moment where Kirk talks about losing his brother, and there's you're not sure if he's talking about Spock or George, and he's probably mainly talking about Spock at that point. I forget which movie that is. But
I guess it would have been after The Wrath of Khan, right?
Right. So he's probably not even talking about George at that point. So this isn't an episode that factors deeply into William Shatner Kirk's life. But I feel like they're setting this up to be a big part of the JJ Kirk. You know, I don't know if it'll be brought up in the movie, but at least as far as doing the comics, they said, here's something interesting that happened to our character. Let's go there and let's see what we can really do with that. And so they even start the comic with a complete departure, as I was about to say before the spoiler warning, of showing a flashback to what actually happened after he drove the Corvette off the cliff. You know, it didn't just end there. There was a whole thing where we see his uncle, who is played by Greg Grunberg. We actually see him finally, and when we see what sort of kid Kirk was and how, and we're starting to see how that rocky childhood turned him into the Chris Pinekirk that we're starting to get to know and love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was glad to see them open it this way instead of just trying to retell the original episode. And now you really do feel like they're using this comic series as a way of building up to the next movie and future movies as well.
Yeah.
You know, developing the characters. Because we talked about before, one of the big complaints in the first JJ movie is that there wasn't really any character development going on. It's
right.
Just, how they met. I found it interesting. Did you notice on this one frame here when they're in Kirk's bedroom and he's kind of daydreaming that there is the Enterprise NX-01?
Yeah, I love that. It's got the Eagle from the Apollo. It has sort of the Wright Brothers airplane, and it has one of the space shuttles, and then it has the NX-01, which is one of those great little tie-ins. I'm sure it makes the Gorn captain very angry, but I love it. It's great to see. This actually wouldn't be that long after. I'm sure Columbia was still flying at this point, even if, well, I don't know, maybe they put that one in mothballs too.
It could be. But yeah, there's not that much time between the Enterprise time period and when Kirk was a young kid. Because how old is he here? I don't know, they don't say. He's like,
yeah, he's got to be
7,
12,
8,
13.
Something like that.
Oh, you think he's that young? I thought he was a little bit older, but
anyway, he's an adolescent at any point.
He's an adolescent, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's great to see those little tie-ins. I'm sure there was, now we're going to find out there's another Enterprise in between the NX-01 and the 1701. That'll be the next series they do.
That's right. We'll say, we're going to get that prequel right this time.
Yeah, exactly.
But from there on, it plays it fairly close to the original episode initially, with the ship flying in the sun and so forth. I felt like it deviates a little bit as they get down onto the ground. The amoeba creatures are, I think, a bit scarier here. Certainly the way Spock is attacked is more frightening, is more threatening to Spock than having a fried egg on your back.
Right. One thing I wanted to bring up before we get to the bubblegum amoebas is the this red shirt that they have with them, not the one with the mustache, but the one in the dress uniform.
Yeah.
Was that a uniform seen in the movie? I think this is a new uniform.
Oh yeah, I think so. That looks like the J.J. Abrams. I don't know. It looks a lot like Uhura's red dress uniform to me. Does it look different to you?
I'm trying to remember what she wore in the movie. But I do like the take on the miniskirt, the Abrams take on the miniskirt, whether it was seen in the movie or not.
She wears the red miniskirt in the movie.
Okay. Okay.
Now there are points in the movie where she's wearing like pants.
Okay.
As well. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And not red. Like when they're cadets, I guess, when they're doing the training, like the Kobayashi Maru scene and all.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's part of what we're talking about, but the camera just moves around so much that you can barely even see the uniforms. I love that the comics lets us just look at the uniforms and see what we actually think of them. And I really love the Abrams take on the uniforms. And this
The camera might be moving a lot, but I took in all of the scenes in which Zoe Saldana appeared.
So. I'm sure you did, Chris. I'm sure you did.
Let me ask you, did you notice there's one little thing in here that's very interesting? Did you notice that at one point Kirk calls up to the Enterprise? And did you notice how he called up to the Enterprise?
I did not notice this in particular. What are you speaking of?
He taps his insignia on his shirt.
Does he
and it
really?
Says, it says like this above the insignia.
Oh, wow. Which page is that? Because now I want to find that.
It's hard to find on the iOS when I think. If you try
it. Oh, there it is.
On,
I'm finding it. It's after Spock's been.
Right.
Yeah, so apparently, wow. Not only did the incursion by Nero cause the starships to become more advanced and gigantic, but it's even advanced to the point where they don't have the hand communicators anymore. They've already moved to the badge communicator.
Apparently, very quickly between movies, I guess.
Right. I mean, between the movie and 2 months later, they've already moved forward to that.
That's right. So that was an interesting little thing. I'm going to assume that it's just a mistake on the writer's part. Writers who grew up watching the Next Generation era TV shows.
It must be. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe this is a hint that,
we'll
it's another hint to the next movie
Could
that
be.
We're going to see them. you know, tapping their pecs to speak to the ship.
Tap the pec. All right. All right. Well, I guess the other thing just to talk about here is how it ends.
Yes. It's a very interesting ending. I mean, leading up to it, we've got this huge dramatic thing, you know, more extras than the original show could muster. What I call the bubblegum amoeba, which sort of encapsulates Spock's head, but it's sort of semi-transparent. And they as we will talk about on the feature that you've not heard yet, but we have done.
reverse recording.
Dramatic storytelling requires that you write yourself into a corner and then find a way out. And here they are. On one side are the you know, angry mob. On the other side, angry mob. Spock has his head covered in bubblegum. What are we going to do? And what are we going to do? But out from the floor comes George Kirk.
Yep, who was dead in the original series, but here he is alive and is going to be kind of like a resistance fighter, it appears. Yeah. But he's going to help his brother Kirk, James T. Kirk.
Very interesting. And I guess this will dispel any rumors of Benedict Cumberbatch playing George Kirk in the next Star Trek film.
Because he's appearing here, so he's not going to be in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Gary Mitchell won't be in the next film because he's in the comic. And I guess I think we can assume that George Kirk, you know, unless they're setting it up, you know, maybe George Kirk will become a regular crew member. You know, perhaps he'll replace Chekhov at the helm.
That's possible. After this, they'll bring him up to the ship and they'll fly off with him.
Yeah.
I kind of like the rumors that Benedict Cumberbatch is going to be playing Daner.
Wow.
Do you see the resemblance a little bit?
I could see it. You know, you got the look in her eyes and the look in his eyes. It's possible.
Wow. All right.
Somehow I don't see them going in that direction, but you never know.
You never know. You never know. So we have to wait a month now until number 6 comes out and we can get the resolution to the story and we can find out how this ends.
Yep.
I'm expecting it to deviate quite a lot from the original episode now.
Certainly.
Like you said, I think at this point, I kind of like what they did here. As I look back at it, it's like, first one, let's play it straight. Second one, let's mix it up a little bit, kind of ease the fans into the idea that things are changing in this alternate timeline. And now they're to the point of using an original episode, but just as a basic framework to tell their own story. And then we know in number 7, we're going to actually be getting completely original material.
And that's already, right? Like this is the last, well, I don't know. It's not the last original series episode they'll do, but they're doing 3 episodes and then they're doing an original storyline for those the two in March and April. So yeah,
that's right.
It's already coming up, and we'll have to see. I don't think we've heard announced yet what they're doing after that, but it'll be interesting to see if they go for more original stories or if they do more episodes or if it's a mixture of the two.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a mixture personally, but I do think you won't see them just doing original series episodes every single time.
Right.
From that point forward, I think.
But yeah, I agree with you. I like what they're doing with this. I like that they've eased us into it. I'm really excited for next month. I think we're going to do a whole feature on Operation Annihilate and the comic. Sort of the way we've, at least we did for Galileo 7. I don't remember if we did that for Where No One Has Gone Before. No Man Has Gone Before.
Yeah, but we did do for Galileo 7. We had Mike Rittenhouse on with us for that one, I remember.
Right. Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to doing that next time and really digging into the episode and digging into the differences and really talking about the universe that the comic is creating. I feel like it's a much bigger universe than the Abrams movie created. I feel like this is showing us many different planets, many different facets of these characters, showing us a lot more background characters. It's just making it feel like a universe. And it's making me actually really excited for the next film, more so than if I just had 2009 to rewatch.
One of the most famous episodes from the original series is Amok Time, where Spock deals with the Ponfar. And then in Star Trek III, we get to see Lieutenant Savick help young Spock through the Ponfar as well. So naturally, as Voyager had a Vulcan as part of the main cast, we fully expected that they would return to the Ponfar, and that they did in the episode Blood Fever. And today we'll talk about that episode, and of course Greg is with me, and we also have Voyager editor Charlene Schmidt with us. Hello, Charlene.
Hey, thanks for having me back, guys.
Yeah, welcome.
Well, you know, Charlene, I had to have you back. I was thinking, I mean, obviously, as the Voyager editor, you should be on the Voyager show. But more importantly, as I was listening to a recent episode of the Delta Quadrant podcast that you co-host, and you guys were talking about prime factors, and seeing how much insight you had into the love lives of the crew of the Voyager, and how, you know, why couldn't Harry Kim just hang around on that planet a little bit longer before returning to the ship? And, you know, and as you explained all the clues that she was dropping to Harry, and I thought, well, who better to have on to talk about the Ponfar than Charlene?
So I'm not only the Voyager editor, but I'm the relationship expert, hey?
Right. Very.
That's right.
Wow.
You're going to be doing that advice
column.
Dang,
that's awesome.
Soon, right?
Can you explain to us why Troy and Worf didn't really work out? I think you're...
Boy, I'm going to be the Dr. Ruth of Trek FM.
There you go.
That's awesome. And I'm a little bit taller than her.
And tell us, just what exactly is the deal with Riker?
Right.
What's the appeal?
Right.
I like it. And just, yeah, poor dumb Harry, he just can't get any. That's all I have to say about that.
It does seem that way, not even with the Delaney sisters, right?
Yeah.
No, he needs to take a lot more lessons from Tom Paris before anything will ever happen.
True. All right, well, let's talk about Blood Fever a bit. So first off, we're revisiting the Ponfar. When Voyager first kicked off, or when you started watching it for the first time and you knew that you had Tuvok, you finally had a Vulcan, you know, on the crew again as part of the main cast. Did you expect them to go to Ponfar at some point?
Yeah, certainly at some point, because... if TNG's run was any indication, the show is going to go for 7 years, and the Vulcans go through Ponfar every seventh year of their adult lives. So I figured at some point, we are going to see this happen. It was just a matter of when.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think, when I was watching Voyager, I was still pretty young, and I don't think I connected the dots between the original series and Voyager quite to that extent that I was waiting for Tuvok to go through Ponfar. Actually, come to think of it, I wasn't allowed to watch this episode when I was a kid because my parents saw the previews the week before, and I guess it showed Tom and B'Elanna rolling around on the floor together, and they figured, you know, this one's not a good one for my kids to watch. I think I ended up watching the VHS one night when my parents were out at a restaurant or something, so I did get a chance to see it. But
you had to sneak it, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. This, instead of having magazines stuffed under the mattress,
exactly,
or something, he had a VHS tape of Blood Fever.
I had illicit Star Trek Voyager episodes, yes.
You know you're a nerd when.
Exactly.
That's right. They were just afraid you might go in and bite one of your friends on the face.
Well, I was saying on Twitter that I mean, Roxanne Dawson can bite me on the face anytime she wants.
That's an invitation right there.
Oh, I don't know what to say there, other than I already knew that about you.
Yes. So. This is not a revelation.
From past conversations. All right. Well, how do you think they handled the Ponfar in this episode?
I thought they handled it rather well. And you know what's interesting is when this first aired, I thought, you know, they'd ruined it. Like, they missed up on a bunch of details for their own convenience because of lazy writing. You know, it's happened in Voyager before, certainly. And I thought, well, aren't they supposed to fight to the death? And, you know, what is it with getting B'Elanna infected with the blood fever? I didn't realize that the original series, to some extent, had already addressed those things. And what I did in preparation for this is I rewatched Blood Fever, and then I rewatched Amok Time.
Oh, okay, great.
And the one thing that didn't quite clear up for me was the telepathic bond with B'Elanna, basically injects her with the blood fever, gets her started on that. We never really learn for sure what happens when Vulcans kind of do interspecies mating. You know, we never discussed when Sarek and Amanda were basically creating Spock, if she was infected with the blood fever as well. You know, it was not addressed, and since they're so secretive about it, of course, they're not really going to talk about it. So we're just going to have to give them the benefit of the doubt that, especially with her half-Klingon nature, that it's really going to affect her in a profound way. And, you know, okay, fine, I'll buy it. But back then, I just thought, oh, this is just the lousiest excuse to make Roxanne Dawson pant on camera for several minutes and get her all sweaty, and then she'll roll around with Tom. And, you know, this was the way to further the relationship. And it was. But I give him a lot more credit now than I did, because they were actually fairly accurate on a lot of the Ponfar rituals and how things were done. And so, you know what? It's a pretty good episode.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I'm always surprised when I go back and watch the episode that it is B'Elanna going through the Ponfar that's the focus of the episode. Obviously, you'd think it'd be Tuvok. Did they ever, as an aside, did they ever go back and do Tuvok going through Ponfar, like in a later season?
He did, later on, and I don't remember which episode, but it is addressed.
So they did end up doing him, but they could have done the whole thing being just about Vorik going through Ponfar. But obviously they wanted to do a main character, they wanted to defy expectations. So it's a little weird the way they did it. And it's really strange, as you say, that they don't understand. I mean, that Vorik didn't understand that he was doing a telepathic bond with B'Elanna.
Well, I get the impression that Vorik is very... No, I don't think he did. He played it as... I think he's very young. Like, it was his first Ponfar.
Yeah, that's very possible.
He didn't really understand what the emotions were, what he was feeling. And he explains to Tuvok about when he grabbed B'Elanna's face. And he said, oh, I was trying to be gentle. But then I felt this urge, you know, to hold tighter. And I think he didn't realize that he could transfer to her in that way.
Well, I think this really speaks to the need of Vulcan schools to have more Ponfar ed.
I think so, yeah.
Because, you know, there's important things, you know, to practice safe Ponfar. And one of them is, you know, don't do a telepathic bond with somebody who's, you know, a member of another species, who isn't really interested. You know, you can't just go laying your hands on the chin of just anybody.
That's right. If you're feeling... if you're feeling these emotions, be sure to always wear gloves.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And then, of course, the schools are saying, no, 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 this is an issue between the parents. The parents are the ones that need to talk to their kids about Ponfar ed.
I could just picture all the Vulcan teenagers in the Ponfar education class and their, you know, their cheeks and their ears are turning green.
Right. You know, the teacher has everybody, shout, Kun Ut Kaifi. And everybody just starts giggling.
Right.
That's right.
Here was another thing I thought of that initially I was kind of irked about, but then I've later retracted that. I thought he was rather late for his first Ponfar, because he appears to be a 20-something-year-old man.
Yeah.
And in Star Trek III, we see Spock going through his first Ponfar as appearing like about a late teenager, which, you know, kind of makes a little more sense, because humans go through their... you know, their puberty years, teenage. So I thought, well, boy, isn't that awfully late? But then in Amok time, Spock is well past that point in his life. And the context is that this is his first Ponfar as well, because he's meeting up with his wife, whom he has the arranged marriage. And presumably it's the first time. That's not confirmed. But it seemed like they hadn't seen each other, ever, or at least since their marriage was arranged. And so, maybe there's a big variance. And then there was also that theory from Lisa, who wrote an article for Trek FM, that maybe spacefaring Vulcans kind of have a variance, because space does something to that cycle to them.
Right.
That's, yeah.
It's possible. I mean, it's a lot of a cheat by the writers because they don't want to nail down exactly what the rules are. They don't want to be forced to do a Ponfar episode because they laid down the rules are, you know, on this date, he's going to go through it. So it's very much up in the air about what exactly it is. My feeling was always that the parents sort of arranged the first Ponfar and they just sort of, you know, it wasn't terribly serious. They just sort of let them run off and then the marriage was a later thing. But I don't know because it's never been really solidified. I didn't get the sense this was Vorik's first. It was just he wasn't expecting to go through it so soon.
Well, in the Cloudminders, doesn't Spock essentially tell Droxine that it doesn't have to be every 7 years?
And there's that
if he
too.
Finds an extra pretty girl.
Right.
So, I don't know. In this one, yeah, I think it's interesting that we all read these episodes a little bit differently, I think, because I really got the impression that this was Vorik's first time and he didn't know what was going on or how to react to it. Whereas with Spock in A Mock Time, I didn't get the impression that it was his first time. I got the impression that it was something that, you know, he knew this happens. Now, obviously, the marriage, you know, and having T'Pring going to see her, that was maybe the first time, like they were supposed to get married. I think it's a case where the writers, they have these different ideas, you know, like Greg was saying, it's, they kind of don't, either don't want to nail down the details or in the case of A Mock Time, they're just making it all up right there.
Right.
So it doesn't all mesh. Obviously Spock, that couldn't have been his first time because how old is Spock in the original series? I mean, he's already over 100 years old, I think, isn't he?
True.
Something close to that. And Tuvok is very old. I mean, Tuvok is married and has children. So when he goes through it later in the series, it would have been something he's been through many times. And even in this script, I think originally, I mean, you would think, well, Tuvok's going to go through it. But the fact that he was married and had children and was older made it kind of inappropriate for them to go the route of him. So they had to have other crew member.
Even trying to give him a holographic girlfriend would still be a little weird, and I don't think the viewers were going to like it.
Yeah.
What did I say? Yes.
No, you didn't say anybody. You just said him, but I'm thinking,
in
the case of Tuvok doing that.
Because he's got a wife and kids
that.
At home, the people are always going to be concerned about, you know, well, what about his wife and kids? And this isn't somewhere that Star Trek, at least not in this point in its run, not Star Trek Voyager, was really going to have him cheat on his wife. So I totally understand why they went this different direction. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. There's a really interesting episode to be had, and I need to remember exactly what happens in the Tuvok episode, because it is interesting. What happens when you aren't near your family and you have these urges? It's a really interesting thing, just to get back to the episode, about Vulcans, that they do suppress their urges, but they have this systematic way of letting emotion take over. And I don't know, one of these days we're going to get a Voyager show, just a Voyager Star Trek show that's really going to deal with some of this stuff. And it's going to really show us what it's like when they go through their first Ponfar. You know, is that just a girlfriend? Do they have to go find a wife right then and there? Is it the Vulcan teenage years? Or are they in their 20s or 30s when they have their first time? These are questions that have not really been answered, but it's really fascinating because they don't talk about it. And Vulcans love talking. Vulcans love logic. And this is something that is sort of the antithesis of everything Vulcans are about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let me ask you another question here then, because you're talking about how Vulcans like to talk, like logic, talk about this. But when it comes to the Ponfar, it's supposed to be very secretive. And one thing I found odd in here, though, is that when they're in sickbay, the doctor says that there's virtually nothing in the database about Ponfar. And it struck me as odd. I'm like, well, I can understand that they don't like to talk about it with their crewmates or their friends, but come on, it's a medical condition in a sense.
Right.
Vulcan is one of the founding worlds of the Federation. You're telling me that the Federation medical database has almost no information about Ponfar in it?
Right.
Yeah, that's illogical.
Buy that part, personally.
Yeah, I mean, at least McCoy is going to have some information that he's written in the database, unless he had some sort of gentleman's agreement with Spock that he wasn't going to write down anything. Surely.
But I, But I'm just thinking of Vulcan doctors. I mean, how irresponsible would it be as a mm-hmm. physician to omit this information when members of your race are going to be traveling on deep space missions and yeah. are going to obviously go through the situation? So that was, I mean, it didn't detract from the episode for me or anything, but just as a point of, you know, Star Trek, making Star Trek believable, the, yeah. making the whole universe and how everything fits together, I found that to be kind of odd. And especially since the Doctor is supposed to be the embodiment of like all of the greatest physicians in Star Trek history all put together into this EMH program.
Right. Well, I mean, it does go to the fact that Vulcans are at their core a very contradicting species. You know, they're logical, but they have Ponfar. They never lie, and yet they get around that prohibition pretty much whenever they feel like it. You know, mm-hmm. they don't have a sense of humor, and yet they obviously do. So it really goes to that this is another case of Vulcans saying one thing, you know, that they and then yet doing another thing. There's no logical reason that they wouldn't have, at least for doctors, they wouldn't have a reason that they wouldn't have this in the database. But here we are.
I also like that the Doctor, about halfway through the episode, the Doctor comes up with this ingenious solution to create a holographic girlfriend for Vorik, whereas I was watching this episode.
They call
with
that
my
the
wife.
Riker maneuver.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The Doctor says, "Vorik, I'd like you to meet Minuet." Vorik's like, "Wait a minute. Is she a real Vulcan?" Yeah. Don't mind the shoddy nature of her pointed ears. No, I was watching this episode with my wife, and I mean, like in the first 5 minutes, as soon as it starts, she's like, "Why don't they just make a holodeck program for it?"
Right.
You know, and then the Doctor, like 20 minutes in, comes up with this solution, and he's going to tell Starfleet about it when he gets back and all this. It's a pretty obvious solution. But I said, because if they do that, right. the episode will be over.
Exactly. Yeah, well, that's a question. Like, would the holographic thing work? Is it just that Vorik is such a snob about his Ponfar that he won't go through with it? Or is it actually that Vulcans need an actual physical, not a human being, but an actual person?
Yeah, that is the question that's asked here, too, because the Doctor says that it's primarily a mental thing. So the question is it a mental thing or is it a physical thing? Because then when they talk about, it's the blood fever and B'Elanna's going to die. Tom, if you don't help B'Elanna now, she's going to die. That's like it's a physical thing, right? But then they're also playing at the angle, well, the holodeck won't work because it's a mental thing. So which is it?
Right. Well, and my question is, okay, if the holographic thing isn't going to work, why not hold Star Trek Bachelor? You know, sort of have work up there, bring all of the, you know, Vulcan human crew members, you know, anybody who, you know, surely there's somebody who's got a crush on Vork who'd love to help him through this time.
Well, I like that too, because in the selection process, when they only have a few bowls of Plomeek soup to hand out and everyone's nervous, like, am I going to get the last bowl of Plomeek soup?
Right.
The thing was, is he made the bond with B'Elanna.
Yes.
So I think he's so fixated on her that it just wouldn't matter.
Yeah. I think I think you're absolutely right there, that he really wanted it to happen with B'Elanna and it wasn't ever going to happen. I don't want to jump to the ending, but it was an interesting way of finishing it to allow them just to fight to dispel the blood fever. It's sort of an ending I didn't quite see coming.
Well, if we talk about the fight, I mean, just to jump ahead again and then we'll come back, but so you like the fight scene. Did that work for you? It was just, was it interesting or did it also work for you?
It worked for me as far as a conclusion of the episode. I would have rather they had gone through with the, just let Tom and B'Elanna go at it there.
But that's because
I think
that's because you had that VHS tape.
Exactly. Well,
I don't know. I like the way they built that tension and then couldn't and didn't follow through with it.
Right.
Because then it creates that wonderful, awkward scene later on.
That is very true. Yeah, in the turbolift.
Mm-hmm. And I just love that. Careful what you wish for, Lieutenant.
Right.
Well, one of the strong points of this episode is the character development for Tom and B'Elanna and for their relationship. And so in that sense, Charlene, like you said, the fact that they build all that up and they didn't actually act on it, I think it showed that they actually had the potential that that was going to be a mature relationship that they were going
right.
to yeah,
have in the future.
For once.
And, well, it also highlighted how Tom Paris had evolved over mm-hmm. 3 years. This is third season.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
A little over halfway through. You know, from the ladies' man who flies at women at warp speed when they're in visual range in Caretaker to this point, you know, where he obviously likes B'Elanna and cares for B'Elanna, and he's not the same like young hotshot ladies man anymore that he was in season one.
Yeah, he's actually shooting her down because of the situation that they're in, and it's of course incredibly awkward.
Yeah.
But he's trying his best to be a gentleman and say, this isn't really you. You're kind of under the influence of some major hormones here, and you know, I'll wait until you're actually sane.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, we on this show, we like to go back to the original script. And this is a case of an interesting sort of last-minute change where originally it was to be B'Elanna and Tuvok trapped in the cave together.
And oh, really?
It was completely different because it was going to be Tuvok, you know, using his Vulcan wisdom and Vulcan logic to help her through it. And they sort of decided that's not nearly as interesting as having it be her and Tom in the cave.
No, but that would have been so boring.
It really would have been.
It would have been, yeah.
But so in this case, they were rewriting these scenes on the go. Like right before they shot, they were writing dialogue between Tom and B'Elanna, which is fantastic because in the end, that becomes what the show is about. As you say, it's all about furthering B'Elanna and Tom. But if you think when they first came up with the idea of the episode, that wasn't the idea at all. That totally came organically, as I love to say on the show, out of the chemistry between Robbie and Roxanne. It came out of, as they were thinking about what they want to do in the future with the characters. And yeah, I think those scenes, that's the best part of the show, is those handheld shots, you know, with the flashlight, the wrist flashlights on everybody's faces. Those are the most interesting scenes of the show and possibly of the first, you know, half of the season or half of the show.
Yeah, I agree. Those were great shots, too, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we should mention Andrew Robinson, who plays Garak on DS9. Mm-hmm. This was his first directorial assignment ever.
Yeah, I thought he was just a tailor.
Apparently not.
He's just a simple tailor. That's right.
No, he did a very good job.
He really
well,
did.
It's because he had a lot of directors from, you know, all around the galaxy coming in to his shop on DS9. And,
right.
you know, as he always said, if you just listen, you learn a lot. And
that's true. And Garak was not stupid. He listened.
Yeah.
That's how he got so good at directing.
That does
even
explain.
Before he had ever had a directing job before.
Yeah. I guess Chris Nolan is a director who always wears these really nicely tailored suits. Perhaps he gets them from Garak on DS9.
Yeah, maybe.
You're right.
Chats with him about the directing process. But yeah, Voyager rarely did handheld shots. And I don't know if that was Robinson's idea or if it was the director of photography. But to really get that camera in close, have life to it, as Ronald Moore talks about, and really have us feel the emotions of the characters rather than this detached, the camera's either on a tripod or a dolly, and it feels very lifeless most of the time on Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an episode that really breaks from that in a fantastic way.
It does, and it certainly brings to completion the intimacy of that scene, mm-hmm. those, you know, the whole thing. It really just, kicks it to another level.
Really
it's
does,
great.
Yeah.
I'm glad that they changed these lines, because I think that if Tuvok had been the person in the cave with her, and it would have been a very different episode, because it would have been... B'Elanna would still have been the focus of the person going through the blood fever, but the focus would have been much more on how do Vulcans cope with Ponvar,
right.
because mm-hmm. Tuvok would have been the star of the show, even though he wasn't going through Ponvar. And they said too that kind of the idea would have been that he would have helped her through the Ponvar, which to me suggests that he would have, you know, helped relieve her needs there during the Ponvar, and then he would cope with it as a Vulcan because he, you know, has been through it and he knows what Vulcans have to do. Like somehow he would have been able to do what Tom could not do, and then he would just kind of cope with it himself because he's an older, wiser Vulcan. But definitely changing it, which apparently they changed it like the day before they shot. I mean, yeah. It was just like a sudden change. Get rid of all the Tuvok stuff, replace him with Paris. But it did make this episode meaningful within the larger Voyager canon, Voyager storyline. Whereas if they had not done that, it would have just been like a bottle show about Ponfar only.
Right. And I'm so glad that they didn't, because the Paris and Taurus relationship ends up being one of the best things in Voyager, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because
definitely.
Because unfortunately, I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, but Star Trek tends to not deal with sex in a very mature way sometimes. And this was one of the first rare instances of seeing senior officers, you know, manage a relationship, get married, have a baby on the way. I mean, the only other example I can think of right now is the O'Briens. But senior staff members hasn't really happened before. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, not really. I mean, you have Dax and Worf, but that was different.
Oh, that's
they
true.
Didn't have kids. Yeah, but they didn't have kids, and Dax died soon after they were married as well.
Right.
True. So that was short-lived, whereas Tom and B'Elanna took it over several years of the course of the series.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really feel like the Tom and B'Elanna thing is not something they thought they were going to do going into the series. That it really came out of, as Robinson talks about, listening to the actors and actually watching the show and seeing what's actually going to work. We talked the past couple episodes about the original script and the bonding. The ending was changed from being a holodeck to being an alien, and how it kind of ruined the episode to some extent. And then last episode, we talked about how the three random Klingons were changed to Kor, Koloth, and Kang, and how it was great for fans of the original series, but then didn't end up affecting it too much. But here is a case of a last-minute script change that really made a huge difference. I mean, it's possible that later on they would have still developed the Tom and B'Elanna relationship, but this is the episode where really it stops being, oh, Tom's got a crush on B'Elanna, isn't that cute, to maybe they have an actual chance together.
Yeah.
And it's sort of frustrating. This is an episode that I think I did see it eventually, several months later, but it's one that you kind of have to see, even though Voyager is an episodic show. It's not serialized. But this is one that pushes forward their relationship, and later episodes are based on it. And then we'll talk about the Borg showing up. That's a very important thing. And if you miss that, you've missed out on something interesting that's coming up as well. So this is an interesting case in the life of Voyager, of an episode that really it feeds on secondary characters that we'd seen in the past. Vorik, you know, bring him to the forefront. It talks about storylines that have been in the past, and it leads to storylines in the future. Which, if you think about Voyager, that really does not happen very often, at least with them not completely messing it up, like the whole Year of Hell thing.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it was interesting here with Vorik that he shows up quite a few more times during the series, because you would expect that, like, well, he was here. He was in two episodes before this, which I have a feeling were largely a setup for this. Like, we have to have another Vulcan on the ship. Hmm. We can't just bring somebody in out of the blue for this episode. So let's kind of establish that there's this other Vulcan around, right?
Right.
But then he does show up in, let's see, five episodes, I think, as the series goes on.
I believe that is right.
In season four, season five, and then he's there again in season seven. So even after this whole incident happens, you know, he manages to stay on the ship and for the whole journey. And I don't remember them ever really exploring any aftermath of this, though, in terms of his character.
Maybe that's a little bit
of a missed opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, the episode right before this one had Vorik in it and sort of led to this episode. There's a little bit of interesting continuity there where they set up this episode. But no, they never really go back and deal with it. I always wonder how much his involvement in the show is a cameo just because he's an actor and he's the son of one of the producers, and how much they love the character and want to bring him back. I mean, I love that there's more than one Vulcan on the ship. DS9 has like no Vulcans, and that was really frustrating. TNG had no Vulcans.
Yeah. I mean, you assume that there are some Vulcans around, but you never see them. You know, they never show up
somewhere.
In the episode.
Right, you know, just during some random TNG episode, somebody runs by going through the Ponfar, but we never see it actually featured on screen.
And then Argyle's chasing him down the hallway.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
TNG is such a big ship that I always imagine there's at least five other storylines going on at the same time.
Oh, exactly.
And we just never see it.
Yeah. They should release a whole, like, a 7-season set of B-sides.
Right.
It's like everything else that was going on the ship during that episode that you didn't see.
That would be awesome.
Lower Decks. It could be like a web series. You could do a whole Lower Decks web series.
Yeah.
Like it.
Oh, yeah. So you mentioned there that Alexander Enberg, who plays Vorik here, is Jerry Taylor's son.
Mm-hmm.
For those who aren't aware. So he just kind of shows up in quite a few episodes here and there.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I'm not going to shout nepotism because he really is good and brings an interesting element of young Vulcan to the show. We've only seen older Vulcans, but this is a kid, basically. I mean, sure, he's a Vulcan, so he's probably 30 or 40 years old, but he's very young and inexperienced, and he has this schoolboy crush on B'Elanna, which is kind of adorable.
Something you can identify with, I take it.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, but you're right. Enberg does do a really good job here with Vorik and bringing out both the kind of confusion over what's happening to him at some points and then the kind of the extreme anger as well, because we know Vulcans, although they suppress their emotions and hide behind this logic all the time, you also get the feeling that Vulcans are probably actually much more emotional than humans are even, and they just kind of hide that all the time. And so when something like this happens, it all comes out, and I think Enberg did a good job of conveying that, especially towards the end when they actually, you know, get to the actual fight. But at the end, this is one thing that got me towards the end. We talked earlier a little bit about the fight scene, and I wasn't really crazy about the fight scene at the end, though, for a couple of reasons. One, I felt like the only reason there was a fight scene was because there was a fight scene in a mock time between Kirk and Spock, and so it was established that there's this Kunit Khalifi, and you have to have a fight scene. You have to fight to the death. And I like the fact that B'Elanna wanted to fight for herself because that was B'Elanna's character.
Right.
You know, yeah,
that's
absolutely
what you would expect. The fight itself, it was going on. I thought it was a little bit silly. It reminded me of the old Wild West barroom brawls that you had to have in the original series all the time. But what got me most about it was that after it was over, Tuvok just says, "The blood fever has been purged. They will recover."
Right.
Something like that. I'm like, wait, so I thought this was all about mating, right?
Right.
You have this urge, you have to mate or you're going to die. But it turns out that if you just beat the crap out of your crewmate for 2 minutes, the fever breaks.
Yeah. It's a big cop-out. I mean, didn't in a mock time, Charlene and Chris, you can tell me, but didn't they have to fake Kirk's death in order
for the
blood fever to break in that episode?
And that's why I thought initially blood fever was cheapened because they didn't fight to the death. Only, you know, I rewatched Amok Time and it turns out that they just gave that illusion that Kirk had died. And what McCoy did is he gave Kirk some kind of neural toxin that simulated death. And so here's the question, though. Do you have to believe that, you know, Kirk was dead in order to purge the blood fever? Or, you know, how does that work exactly?
Well, that seems to be the implication, that you have to believe you have killed the other party in order for it to go away. And that clearly does not happen here. They do just sort of roll around in the dirt and punch each other a little bit, and then it breaks. And it does totally go against what they've set up. And you're right. That is pretty frustrating.
Well, think about moving forward. Now, think about if they did have a fight to the death and B'Elanna kills Vorik, because Vorik is not a main character. I'm being serious here. Vorik is not a main character, okay? So he could be, you know, like a red shirt you get rid of, right? What if B'Elanna had killed him to purge this blood fever, and then from this point forward in the series, or at least for the rest of the third season, you know, they have to explore B'Elanna, the fact that she killed someone, and if she were purely Klingon, you know, she could justify it as being, you know, it's for my honor, but she's not. She's half human. And also, she would have to deal with Janeway as well, being a senior officer and a Starfleet ship, having killed a fellow senior officer. You know, those are other things that you could have explored. It's the kind of thing, again, and we talk about Deep Space Nine a lot on here, even when we're not talking about DS9, but it's the kind of theme that DS9 might have explored, actually. Whereas Voyager, everything's tied up at the end, nice and neat, and let's go on to the next week.
It's the kind of concept they would never, and this is why I sort of giggled when you said it, because sort of thing that would never, ever happen on Voyager.
Yeah.
You know, they're not even, something like Tasha Yar being killed isn't something that really happens on Voyager.
Right. Like something
not
like,
unless the actress wants out of her contract.
Right.
Right. Like an officer being promoted. Never happens to Harry Kim.
Exactly.
Poor dumb Harry.
No, but really, I mean, what do you think about that? Would that have made Voyager more interesting moving forward?
It certainly could have, especially since we learn later on that B'Elanna was a little prone to depression. Do you remember how she was, you know, going on the holodeck for thrill-seeking activities and was kind of going through a little bit of a cloud herself for a while there? I think the fallout from killing somebody like Vorik, even though she had to, you know, in her own defense, in a way, I think there could have been a severe fallout from that, and she would have been dealing with the repercussions of that for a long time. Yeah. And I think it could have been very good, and it could have created some very interesting moments with Tom, maybe trying to help her through it and enhancing the bond through that. But you know, it's one of those things where we just won't ever know. It didn't happen. So
yeah.
I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I the fact of the matter is Tuvok never would have let them fight. I mean, the fact that he sort of says, no, go ahead and let them fight. This is what they need to do. Knowing that you really have to have them fight to the death. But then I guess the writers just didn't want to redo the end of A Mock Time. So they didn't want to do a faking of the death. I feel like they just weren't thinking. They didn't want to push the B'Elanna Tom relationship too far, but they also weren't prepared to do something actually serious, like have her kill him. So I love the episode right up until the ending, but it totally doesn't work for me. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, the ending of the episode just feels rushed. It's like they wrote themselves into a corner that they couldn't get out of. They couldn't have Tom and B'Elanna have sex on Star Trek Voyager. They couldn't have B'Elanna kill Vorik on Star Trek Voyager. And like you said, Tuvok, if he knew they have to fight to the death, he's not going to pit two of his officers against each other,
right,
especially not a senior officer, any officers for that matter, and have them fight to the death. So it all felt rushed to me at the end. And that was the thing for me. Like when he says the blood fever has been purged, it's like the writer saying, okay, we did everything we wanted to do in the episode, which was the Tom and B'Elanna stuff, which was great. But we have to actually end the episode. So here, quickly, let's just scribble this ending down here. And we're done.
I mean, as friend of the show Brian Finifter talks about, one of the rules of screenwriting is writing yourself into a corner and then figuring out how to get yourself out of it. But I feel like this is such a cop-out of doing that. It's like if, you know, First Contact, they follow the Borg sphere through the portal thing, and they start firing on Earth, and then Picard says, stop! And they do.
And they do.
Like, well, that...
Roll credits.
That wasn't a story. That was just, you resolved it because you couldn't think of anything better to do.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I guess that is essentially what they did here.
Yeah.
So that was kind of disappointing. I liked the episode up until that point, like you said, Greg. And then I kind of accept it because that's how you resolve a Voyager story. It's also how a Next Generation story would have been resolved.
Yeah, that's probably true.
You know, it's not... I'm not attacking Voyager for doing it. It's a Star Trek thing. It's why Deep Space Nine was unique and that they were not afraid to actually pull the trigger on something like that. Otherwise, you know, even Enterprise, I mean, would not have resolved the story by having one officer kill another officer. So,
well, unless it's the finale and you want to just kill off an officer for no reason.
And you're late for a meeting. Yeah.
And then that'll be the way to write yourself out of the corner, even though it doesn't even make sense. You'll just have him die.
So I don't know what they would have done here. you know, short of having B'Elanna Kilvorak, I kind of wish that they had found some interesting way to resolve this other than just have them wrestle around for a couple of minutes. Well, and then
the way to do it, know, without retreading a mock time is just have Tom and B'Elanna have sex. I mean, for goodness sakes.
You can't do that on Star Trek.
You can. So. Just have them sort of roll around and then cut away and then have it be okay. And then you still, okay, then you still have to deal with Vorik is going through it, but at least B'Elanna is okay.
I don't know, but I'm picturing, you know, all the controversy that would have caused. I'm picturing all of the UPN affiliates in Alabama that would not have aired the episode.
Well, and I wonder, what would they have done with Vorik then?
Yeah. I mean,
they would have an episode where he was really bitter. He would start like pinning up pictures of B'Elanna on his walls. And on the other wall, he would have pictures of Paris and he would have like a X marks through the faces.
Oh, wow. Vulcan bitterness.
Vulcan bitterness. That's right.
I don't know. Every time I watch the show, I think I'm surprised every time Vorik shows up on the planet because it's a Vorik ex machina because we think Vorik has already had it solved on the holodeck. We think B'Elanna and Tom are just going to go at it on the planet. And it's, to me, that seems like a legitimate conclusion to the episode. I don't need an extra bit of jeopardy. And yeah. I guess the writers felt like they needed it for the episode. I mean, partly because they wanted to do a mock time again. But I think it was fine before he showed up.
I think it's also the problem writers have when you're this deep into the canon of Star Trek II, because it is true that if they had not had the Kunit Khalifi fight at the end, a lot of fans would have been upset because, well, the only way to resolve blood fever is having this fight, you know, and you didn't do it. So it's not Star Trek and that's not canon. And you're rewriting Star Trek and you don't care about Star Trek. So the writers are in a tough spot here. You know, they can't make everybody happy for sure.
Right. Well, how would you have liked to see the episode end, Charlene?
Well, you know, I think I would have liked to have seen Tom and B'Elanna just roll around a little more, maybe do a barrel roll. And see them deal with the consequences of that. But then, yeah, as for Vorik, I suppose you could resolve it with the holographic program. But that just seems kind of bleh.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, unless you replace that, like, the rest of his story with something between Tom and B'Elanna, I'm not sure what else you put in there.
Yeah.
I don't know, it kind of leaves a void if you resolve Vorik that quickly, I think.
Yeah. I think all three of us are in the same boat as the writers here.
Exactly.
Which is not knowing how to resolve.
Why they did what they did.
Yeah. Right. What we need is a writer's room, a lot of pizza, a lot of Mountain Dew, and about 12 hours.
Right.
And what happens on TV is you don't have it. You know, you get to this point and you're just like, I don't know. Let's have them fight, and then they won't kill each other. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Yeah. Just shoot it.
Yeah, because you're not writing a movie. You don't have much time.
Exactly.
It's true. Yeah, they are doing this at a breakneck pace. Let us forget.
They already rewrote half the episode or a quarter of the episode right before shooting.
I
totally understand. They ran out of time and didn't know how to resolve it because it is a really tough episode to resolve. And it's great that they did write themselves into a corner. They got half of dramatic television correct. You know, they wrote themselves into a corner. And as with a lot of Voyager, they didn't write themselves out of the corner as well as they could have.
Right. That's true. Okay, well, let's talk about one last thing here on this, and that's what I call the coda, which is there be Borg here. Now, was this a surprise when they pulled away the leaves and they saw the Borg corpse there? Did this surprise you at all? Because I saw this coming from the beginning of the episode, not the very beginning of the episode, but as soon as they met the camouflaged bird guys down in the caves, I saw this coming.
I thought those looked like the bad guys from Power Rangers.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of reminded me of like weird gargoyle type people.
Oh, yeah. There
I felt like they had like feathers all over them. And I don't know if it was like they had feather hair or that
they
was just
weird.
Their camouflage or what they were.
Something like that.
They're kind of weird, yeah.
Well, I liked when they zeroed in on Tuvok had an elbow replacement. They're like, you have a cybernetic implant. What's up with that?
See, that's a good point. That's
that was kind of cool. But of course, they don't really do anything with that later on, do they? Do they ever mention it again in the series? I don't remember.
Tuvok's elbow. I don't think so.
I don't think they do. I think it's just brought up so that they can, you know, they're sort of laying the hints about the Borg earlier on, which I think is actually pretty cool. Without these aliens who are very distrustful and wondering, you know, how are they detected? That is an element of danger that is needed in this episode. So I'm glad they had it. I don't know though if I realized it was the Borg until they actually uncover the Borg at the end.
Oh, how about you, Sean?
I think it's a good little mystery.
I totally figured it was the Borg because the feather-haired guy, he talks about his civilization, how it was destroyed. You know, it was just a matter of hours. Well, who else could have done that but the Borg?
True.
So I figured, okay, well, that was destroyed by the Borg. But I loved that little clip at the very end revealing the Borg, like, okay, yeah, we are close to their territory, and this is something that's yet to come. I liked it. I liked it a lot. That look Janeway and Chakotay exchanged, like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
It was great. I liked it.
Yeah. And this was what, 2 or 3 years after First Contact? So I feel like there had been... Was it 98, First Contact, right?
Had come out the winter, like right before this episode aired, like, you know, First Contact came out in December or November, and then this episode aired in February the following
year.
97,
Mm-hmm.
Or was it 97?
Yeah.
So there hadn't been as much of a gap between First Contact and this as I thought.
Oh, not at all.
Plus it led to Voyager's big first Borg episode, which was Unity.
Right.
And I think that aired right after this, did it not?
If it wasn't right after, it was just, very, very soon
after.
Yeah,
it was close.
I don't remember if it was the next one, but it was one of the next couple for sure.
Yeah.
This actually aired February 5th of 1997. So in a way,
I'm seeing that now.
It's kind of like, this is Star Trek's Valentine episode.
I hadn't even thought of that. Wow.
And this is how Klingons deal with Valentine's Day. but yeah, as soon as he said that we don't know who the invaders were, but they came and the whole civilization was destroyed in an hour. That's the Borg.
Right.
Has to be Borg. But I really like your point, Greg, which is much more subtle in the writing of Tuvok's elbow implant and those aliens being concerned about cybernetic implants.
Yeah.
That's a very nice touch.
I hadn't caught on to that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, okay, I know it's the Borg. Now, I didn't know that they were going to find a Borg drone in the bushes.
Right.
Of course, and we've talked about the Borg on here a whole lot where Voyager's concerned. Charlene, you did say, we're getting close to their territory. It always makes me wonder, though, you know, the Borg's territory is the whole galaxy. That's what's been established.
That's true.
And because of their transport conduits, but at the same time, Voyager always played it as like there was a very specific part of the Delta Quadrant that was the Borg's territory. So I will assume that that's where their home world was, and they spread out from that point.
Their most conquered area of space, I guess you could say.
Right.
That's where they all hang out.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is where V'ger went and established the Borg community before coming back to Earth.
That's right.
I pretend that V'ger is the origin of the Borg, even though apparently it's not true. I think that's much more interesting than any other explanation.
Well, there are a lot of people who make that connection, and it is reasonable to think that.
Although,
I totally buy it too.
But I think it would have to involve some kind of time travel, because I think the Borg are much older than V'ger.
I think that's the problem.
That's the problem with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it passed through a subspace, you know, the tech on its way to the Delta Quadrant.
I think it went to the Delta Quadrant and it did a slingshot around a sun.
And took some LSD.
Yeah.
LDS. You mean.
Yes.
LDS.
Yeah. And then the people on the Borg homeworld looked up and their oceans started evaporating. And they said, what's going on? It's some kind of cheap satellite probe. Trying to find out where all the other cheap satellites have gone. Where are my dishes?
Someone really needs to write a non-canon novel about this.
They certainly do. We're going to write a whole series of them. All right. Well, why don't we wrap up here anyway on Blood Fever? So any final thoughts that you want to share about the episode that we haven't covered up to now?
Let me think. I think we've actually covered Blood Fever pretty solidly. My favorite bits of the episode are between Tom and B'Elanna, and so I'm really impressed that it was written last minute. There's a quote on Memory Alpha that I'm not finding. It was either Robbie McNeil or Andrew Robinson talking about how the pressure the writers were under and the crew was under at that point really made everybody work to their best, and it created these really fantastic scenes. So I feel like it makes up for the end of the episode being kind of meh, the fact that we had these really great scenes between the two of them. The one thing I haven't brought up, and I wanted to ask you guys what you thought of it, was Robin McNeil didn't like that there wasn't enough reason for Tom to be saying no to B'Elanna. He felt that they didn't give him motivation, that Tom would have just gone for it. What did you guys think? I thought that's exactly what Tom would have done at this point, because he did want a real relationship with B'Elanna.
I liked the way that this turned out, actually. If you would have, you know, had this episode 2 years ago, absolutely he would have gone for it. But I think it shows just how far Tom has come,
right,
as a character. I mean, he doesn't want just a one-night stand with B'Elanna. He wants a real relationship, and in this situation, I mean, he's not looking for instant gratification, if you will.
Right, exactly.
So he's doing his very best to be a gentleman, and hey, I applaud him for it.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, first season Tom, there would have been no reason for him to react that way. So I can understand what Robbie Duncan McNeil was saying there. But at this point, I was fine with it, and it worked fine for me. I didn't think there was anything unusual about it, and I thought it was that additional growth in his character, you know, that you want to see. You don't want your characters to be the same character season after season.
Right. Gasp. So, character development.
No, I think it worked well.
Shocking.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us this week, Charlene. And before we go,
why don't you
tell everybody a little bit about where they can find you? And I know you're now co-hosting the Delta Quadrant, a Voyager podcast.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to make a little plug for the Delta Quadrant podcast. You can find us on iTunes. And we have a website coming up. There's been a couple of issues with uploading our podcast on certain servers. We're exceeding bandwidth and whatnot, so I won't mention that. Look for us on iTunes right now, and then you can get further information from me on Twitter. And my handle is Oh the Profanity. You can find me there, or you can go look up the Delta Quadrant podcast, and they are Delta QUADT _cast. And you can find information on the podcast that way. We record once a week to discuss Star Trek Voyager episodes. And it's a lot of fun. We're kind of a young group. We're getting our stuff together. And I think we're starting to really put it together now, which has been fun. So come on the adventure with us.
All right. Yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes there. So everyone does have to just spell that out. But yeah, definitely, I recommend everyone going and checking them out. I've been listening to the Delta Quadrant and really enjoying the discussions. If you like this part of the Ready Room, if you like our feature segment where we actually kind of have some deeper, serious discussions about the episodes, then you'll enjoy the Delta Quadrant as well. And they're completely dedicated to Voyager.
Well, thanks for the compliment.
Well, Chris, I'm glad to get on. We're sort of on a more of a rotational schedule, rather than doing a lot of DS9 or TNG. We're trying to make sure we hit all the different series. So it's good to get back to Voyager. Blood Fever is an episode I've been wanting to do. Unfortunately, I never got a chance to make the joke I was going to make about how much Vorik was wanting to bond with B'Elanna.
Oh, yeah. This goes back to...
I don't know.
To...
There's some connection. Worf says, you know, I want to bond with the boy, and Vorik says, I want to bond with B'Elanna. And I think they're talking about different things.
I think so, yeah. And I think Riker would want to bond with the holographic Vulcan there as well. So.
Definitely.
But yeah, it was good to talk about this. We decided to do the two Blood episodes back to back, Blood Oath,
yes,
and Blood Fever.
I think we're done. I think there's no more blood, right?
I think those are the only episodes with blood in the title, but I could be wrong about that. I have to go check.
Maybe we can do Battlestar's Blood on the Scales next week.
Oh, well, why not? since we talk about, actually, you didn't talk about BSG very much on today's episode. Just a little bit here and there.
I want it to a lot. Pretty much any time I mentioned DS9 was a time I could have mentioned Battlestar, but instead decided to go with DS9 just to keep it in the family.
Well, I have to commend you. You have great restraint, just like Tom did in the caves in Blood Fever.
Yes, right. I want to make sure that it means something when I bring up Battlestar Galactica. I don't want just a one-night stand with Battlestar Galactica.
That's true. All right. Well, why don't we tell everyone where they can contact us here if they want to share their thoughts on Blood Fever or anything else we talked about today. You can, of course, go to our website at trek.fm/contact and send us a text message. You can also leave us a voicemail if you like. You can call 646-652-TREK. And you can find us on Twitter. The username is TrekFM. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
Yes, indeed. Even when snowed in and without power, I'm still an active Twitter user. You can find me at Greg Harbin, H-A-R-B-I-N. And yes, definitely shoot me a message or shoot us a message on TrekFM. I'm trying to respond to people on both. So let's keep the conversation going. I always enjoy talking with our listeners.
Yeah, we should remind people that when we do respond on Twitter or just tweeting in general from the TrekFM account, I sign my tweets with a hyphen C and Greg with a hyphen G so that you know who is talking. Those are not weird cowboy legs on the bottom of smiley faces right there.
Right. I want to make sure that people understand that, you know, I think people could honestly tell if they knew us which was which, but I think for new listeners, it's good to differentiate.
Right. Yeah, the one with all the flirtatious tweets about B'Elanna Torres and Roxanne Dawson, that'd be Greg. not that I disagree, but that would be Greg who's tweeting those.
Right.
All right. Well, you can also find us, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. You'll find me now with a slightly frightening avatar of my normal avatar assimilated as a Borg by SOPA. So it's my own little Star Trek way of protesting against SOPA. And
very nice. Oh, and I wanted to mention, while we're talking about interacting, anyone in the area, be looking forward to March and the Emerald City Comic Con here in Seattle. I've been talking over, and we're definitely going to have a Trek FM meetup. I have a few people here in the area who will be coming by. So if you're in the area, send us a message on Trek FM and let us know you're interested. I don't know if it'll be a dinner or a pub or just hanging out at the con itself, but that's in March. So hit us up if you're at all interested.
That sounds good. Now, Greg, that's the con where you're going to be carrying the cardboard cutout of me around everywhere you go, dressed in the Borg Queen's outfit, right? Since I can't be
there
in person.
That is the understanding we came to. So I thought it was going to be the Borg Queen. It turns out it's just you in the catsuit.
That's right. As a cardboard cutout, because I cannot actually be there. I know it's going to be a little bit cumbersome to carry that around everywhere, but I really appreciate the effort that you're going to represent there.
No problem. Yeah. Well, it's important that not just me representing Trek FM, but both of us together representing Trek FM. You know, it's more, you know, it's not quite Kirk, McCoy, and Spock, but, you know, Greg and Chris, that's the core of Trek FM, I really feel like.
The Ready Room co-hosts. And I hate to spill this secret right now, but I'm going to have as a cutout, have on the Borg Queen's outfit. Now, Greg is going to be wearing Counselor Troy's burgundy jumpsuit or the lavender jumpsuit. I don't think you've decided yet, right, which one you're going with.
I need to try them both on and just see, you know, which one shows off my assets better.
Now, are you going to go with the bun hair or are you going to wear your hair down?
Probably the bun. You know, I like to go for classic.
All right. Well, if you want to interact with us in other places, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can find us on Google Plus at our own short link, hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. And if you'd like to test your Trek IQ, you can play Trek Trivia on our website at trek.fm/TrekTrivia or follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter for live quizzes several times a week. All right, Greg. Well, I am going to head off and I've got a little job I have to do right now. I've got to mount my new electronic door chime right outside the studio here.
All right, Chris. Yeah, I think it's time to stick some Triox compound in it because the Ready Room is done.